Welcome to It's All Politics from NPR News. I'm Ron Ilkin.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
And Ken, this was a week in which we saw a man literally burn down his political career, his personal life, right there before our eyes on live television.
The Mark Sanford story was, it's simplistic to say it was tragic. And of course, there are a lot of people who were just, you know, jumping up and down. They're excited. It's hypocrisy. It's a conservative Republican.
Certain
blah, blah, blah.
Number of
what
people
they deserved.
Dancing on his grave.
And he did betray his family. He did lie to his staff and the state and the voters who elected him and probably kissed goodbye his 2012 chances.
Probably.
Okay, maybe.
Maybe, yeah. Right. No, he's gone. He's probably going to have to resign even as governor of South Carolina.
I think that's probably true. And yet, between watching him in his press conference on Wednesday and reading those salacious emails,
Are they salacious? They're almost romantic.
Well, they were romantic. They were romantic.
They sound like a schoolboy.
But I felt like I needed a shower after I read it. I just didn't like. There was something about watching Mark Sanford, who's supposed to have political smarts. Well, actually, let me retract that. Let me go back.
What kind of political smarts can we say he had?
Well, let me say that because if he had, what he did with the stimulus was wildly unpopular in South Carolina, refusal to take the $700 million from the Obama stimulus.
They overrode him in a Republican legislature.
And then the state Supreme Court ruled against him. And every Republican I saw quoted said that Sanford was wrong. So for somebody who's supposed to have political smarts, he didn't have it in that case. And he shows up at this press conference without a script, without apparently knowing exactly what to say, and he asked for questions.
Everything about that press conference was
I've never seen anything like it.
Misconceived and disastrously executed.
Interestingly enough, 2 weeks ago with John Ensign, the senator from Nevada, everybody was talking about this is exactly how to deal with this kind of personal scandal. You don't bring your wife, you don't, you know, answer questions, you confess completely. But Ensign seemed polished and
clinical.
Clinical.
He seemed to be in control. He had a script. He stuck to it. Then he did not show up in Washington until things had seemingly blown over. And then he got back here this week and apologized to all his colleagues in the normal course of things in a closed meeting of just the Republican senators.
And nobody seems to be demanding his resignation. I mean,
not many.
I don't think
in Nevada, the polls show people think he ought to stay.
But what's weird about, I guess, look, this is a different kind of scandal. First of all, you disappear for 6-7 days without telling your chief of staff, your lieutenant governor, your wife.
Huge difference.
There was just something so sad about watching.
This is a guy who appears to have just gone over the moon for a person that he met in his late 40s while in the midst of beginning to put himself out on the national stage, first as a potential vice presidential candidate for John McCain in 2008, he was on the short list.
Yep.
He was on the very short list. Uh-huh. And Michael Steele, the Republican National Committee chairman, named him one of the four rising stars that he was keeping an eye on for 2012. That list has not fared very well, I might add. But this is a guy who had serious ambitions. And while, of course, our focus is on the people he betrayed, there is also some human, I think, sympathy for the guy seeing that this was an emotional, a romantic even kind of affair for which he fell.
Republicans thought if they were going to stand up to President Obama, and they haven't done a great job of it so far, let's say, it's fair to say, but the congressional Republicans, I think, fared pretty poorly. And so there's a lot of focus on Republican governors. They would be the alternative. If there was a Republican message coming out of the 06 and 08 elections, it was Republican governors. Sanford was on that list. And the rest of the list doesn't look so great either.
Well, Bobby Jindal, right, from Louisiana, who, by the way, continues to have a lot of success as a legislative leader in Louisiana, changing a lot of laws down there. I think we're going to hear more from Bobby Jindal, but he had a bad rollout speaking after President Obama's speech in February.
The budget speech,
and he gave a response that was not well received.
Not ready for prime time, everybody said, and
that was true. There's another governor up in Minnesota who could have run for another term, and then he decided not to run for another term, probably because he didn't see the prospects of reelection being very good. He was another person people were looking to as a Republican governor.
I think they are. I still think Pawlenty is still high on the list. I think that Mitt Romney, the former governor, is way on top of the list, if not leading the list. Look, here we are in June of 2009. It's kind of crazy to be talking about 2012, but, you know, we keep building up these would-be presidents, the Jindals, the Sarah Palin. We didn't talk about Sarah Palin. And there's a Pew poll that shows her wildly popular.
70% of Republicans approve of her, as opposed to those who don't approve of her.
So there are so many people.
Her approval way outranks her disapproval, more so than any other Republican figure among Republicans.
Well, but that's who will decide the Republican exactly. presidential nomination.
Exactly. That's a formula for real trouble for the party, is that the person they like the most is not necessarily their most popular national figure. But look, Sarah Palin is in a class by herself. She is an enormously well-known figure. Her recognition
for better
is
or for worse.
Much greater than that of Mitt Romney, which is surprisingly low, right. even among Republicans. Newt Gingrich, we think of him as a household name, but not for people under the age of 30. They don't really remember the early 90s. They don't remember the rise of Newt Gingrich. They don't have a whole set of associations about him. They think he's just some wild, white-haired guy they see on television. And they are right about that. But there's no clear sense of who the Republican Party is beyond Sarah Palin.
And yet, one by one, it seems like the possible candidates, if you include John Ensign, which I never took seriously, but they seem to be falling by the wayside. I think whatever the message that comes out of this week is that it's another blow for the Republican Party trying to somehow establish some kind of a reason to be in opposition to President Obama, and yet the Republicans seem to be...
Well, the Republicans have two challenges. They need to come up with a message against Obama, and they need to come up with a person against Obama. And they're probably not going to be able to come up with the latter until they have this presidential process, which is still a couple, 3 years away.
I would say certainly after the 2010 midterms.
That's right.
So perhaps maybe what Barack Obama is most worried about is not Republicans, but those mean reporters, as we saw at the press conference this
week. Oh, yes. You know, this is an interesting hinge in the Obama history. I mean, we're just 5 months into his presidency. But in all the previous news conferences, they would do it in a big formal room like the East Room, and they would have a very formal kind of context. The reporters would stand up and be recognized and ask a question in a formal sort of setting. This was done in the briefing room, where they have hurly-burly every day between Robert Gibbs and the press, and the reporters are much more relaxed there. They sit down, they lean back, they put their feet up, and they fire off multiple level questions, and they are expecting a conversation. And Obama was still hoping to play the professor, the lecturing professor, sort of like me. And he just went on and on in his answers, and the reporters were trying to interrupt him in a different sort of way, and they were much cheekier in the way they couched their questions.
But I thought, I mean, a lot of people said that, well, Obama is, you know, getting terse with the press, and he's showing impatience. But I thought some of the questions were a little silly. I did. I mean, one of the questions was, why did you suddenly become tough on Iran? Or is it because you were watching John McCain and Lindsey Graham? That's what made you become tough? I mean, those are ridiculous questions.
Was that reporter actually expecting Barack Obama to say, yeah, I decided to get tougher yeah, right. because Lindsey Graham and John McCain said I was timid
and
weak.
He laughed at that.
And everybody laughed. There is a tendency on the part of the press to want to goad the president into saying something that's more newsworthy. And also there's a tendency on the part of reporters, and we've both done this. You go to a news conference and you've got a story kind of pre-written. You've got your lead. President toughens language against Iran. And you wait for him to speak to that lead. And if he doesn't, you push him to do it. Right. And we saw a lot of that.
One more thing about the press conference. The president still seems boxed in the corner because he says, I have not given any incendiary language about what's going on around because I don't want to embolden the Ahmadinejads and the Ayatollah.
Do you think, though, that that's just a foolish kind of fastidiousness on the president's part? They're going to say that the United States, the great Satan, is behind all of these demonstrations, no matter what we do.
That's why I was surprised that he was saying he was worried. But he did certainly have a much tougher line on Iran than he did prior to it. But, of course, the situation, I think, had gotten much worse as well, with the crackdowns and the beatings. And also,
he had been pressured by Lindsey Graham.
And John McCain.
And, you know, so he had to follow along behind them.
What about Max Baucus? Who was he pressuring?
Max Baucus, interesting figure from Montana. The guy's been in the Senate forever, and he is now the chairman of the Senate Finance Committee. And while he doesn't make a lot of headlines, he's probably the pivotal figure for the health care overhaul bill.
Not Ted Kennedy.
Well, it would be Ted Kennedy under normal circumstances, but he's very sick. Chris Dodd has been taking over the chores of Kennedy's committee, the health committee. But the real focus point here is on the finance committee, because the question is money.
Right.
And right now we've heard that $1 trillion figure over 10 years. We've also seen it bumped up to $1.6 trillion under certain circumstances over 10 years. If it's really going to cover all the uninsured, it's probably going to be at least that, maybe closer to $2 trillion.
Oh, I'm gonna say, exactly.
Yeah. So money has become the focus. In a sense, that gives the Republicans the message that they've been looking for.
And I think Max Baucus feels the same way. There was an interesting quote. I don't know if it was in a New York Times article, but it said that neither party truly trusts him. And I think they really don't have the confidence in him. So I think he could probably work out, if anybody's going to talk to Republicans and fashion a deal, I would think it would be Max Baucus.
Oh, that's interesting. And instead of saying he can work the deal because everyone trusts
him. Yeah.
Interesting
yeah.
reversal. You know, a little bit like Nixon.
Nobody trusted him either.
Exactly. Yeah, but he can work deals. Yeah.
And he also had some interesting things to say this week on abortion.
It was amazing to be hearing from Dick Nixon again after all this time. Thousands of hours of these tapes that were taken out of the White House, you know, famous back in the Watergate days because the tapes really did him in. And now we're hearing all the rest of the tapes that didn't have to do with Watergate. And these were from January, February 1973.
Which not only was not long after his inauguration for a second term, but also, more importantly, right around the time the Supreme Court ruled in the famous Roe versus Wade decision.
January 22nd, right. 1973. And the next night, he's talking to Chuck Colson, one of his cronies, and Henry Kissinger, Secretary of State. And the conversation wanders on to the court case about abortion. And Richard Nixon...
It would lead to permissiveness, right?
He says he's not sure how he feels about it. It's going to lead to permissiveness, and it breaks the family. But he also adds that there are times when abortions are necessary.
Right. Well, of course, rape is one of them.
And he mentions rape
and there was
as
another
one case.
One?
And the other one was, he says when you've got a black and a white.
Unbelievable.
Incredible. He actually says abortion would be, necessary and understandable in a case of interracial sex. All right. So a little more that we learned about Richard Nixon after all these years, and we thought we knew everything there was to know. It's a gift that just keeps on giving. More tapes to come as we get down to every last conversation the man ever had in the White House.
We did hear from Richard Nixon, but one group that we did not hear from this week are the Republicans in the New York State Senate, because when they had a special session of the legislature this week, the Democrats got into the state Senate chambers in Albany early.
6:30 in the morning.
And they control the audio and visual apparatus there. And so whenever a Republican would speak during this special session, you couldn't hear them.
Well, I wonder what would happen if they were actually to get control of the audio equipment here at NPR. Sounds a lot like our normal podcast.
Well, without belaboring what happened in New York, it was just surreal in a surreal story that's been going on for weeks. The fact is that Governor David Patterson called for a special session of the state Senate. So 31 Democrats, 31 Republicans chimed in.
31 flavors.
And they held two separate, even though they were in the same room, they held two separate hearings of the state Senate. The Republicans passed their own bills. The Democrats passed their own bills. It was as childish as this podcast is sometimes.
Almost. And, you know, we talk a lot about the dysfunctionality of the California state legislature and their relationship with their governor. And they are dysfunctional. And we know that that state has been pushed to the absolute brink of bankruptcy with a $24 billion gap in their new budget, which they don't have any way to close, and they keep shooting down each other's proposals. What's going on in New York, in a sense, is even more puerile and more risible.
Well, I agree with that, but if you can stick for California for a second, I was about to ask you, why would anybody want to run for governor of that state?
Well, in fact, fewer people do. We did have a long list of people, Democrats and Republicans, who were interested in running, and it included one of the stronger candidates, actually, was the current popular mayor of Los Angeles,
Antonio Villaraigosa.
And he has announced this week that he will not be a candidate for that office next year.
His popularity is not as strong as it had been. There are major budget problems in Los Angeles, as there are in most big cities, certainly in California. And he said, by the way, he's going to be sworn in for another term on July 1st. He says he would rather focus on trying to get Los Angeles back on his feet. Now, of course, his numbers have suffered a bit, and I thought he was going to do well because you have these two ostensible Northern California Democrats running,
Jerry Brown and Gavin Newsom.
Right. So you have Villaraigosa, the only Latino, and they're in a state that is more and more Hispanic.
Especially on the Democratic side.
And then, of course, you have two Democrats from the North, Newsom and Brown. Perhaps.
The Battle of the Bay.
So I thought he would do well, and yet, so now it looks like it's going to be just between those two candidates. Loretta Sanchez, by the way, a Hispanic member of Congress, was asked repeatedly to get in the race, and she said this week she would not run.
I think there are a number of people who might be, at some point or another, encouraged to get in the race at this point, but it does look increasingly as though it's going to come down to Gavin Newsom, best known for approving gay marriage in the city of San Francisco.
And who is also, by the way, who's also known, as are Mark Sanford and John Ensign and Antonio Villaraigosa, for having
had extramarital affairs in office.
I think he was separated when he had divorced when he had the affair. But
it was also with the wife of an aide,
exactly,
and it was a very messy situation, very similar to John Ensign's.
And Villaraigosa had an affair with a TV reporter who was covering City Hall. So I think both parties
We're in California now. Yeah. And yet these are real liabilities for these candidates. So the funny thing is that a guy we used to call Governor Moonbeam, when he was actually governor of California for
70s.
Two terms in the 1970s, may be coming back for a third term as governor.
Do you remember who he succeeded as governor?
Yes, the governor before him was a young fellow by the name of Ronald Wilson Reagan.
That's correct.
Yes. And do you know who the nominee of the Republican Party against Jerry Brown was in 1974?
Well, it was Elville Younger, and then it was Elville Younger in 74.
And in 78 it was?
Houston Flournoy.
Very good, Mr. Rudin.
Thank you very much.
You get full marks, and that's it for this week's political podcast.
You can follow NPR's political coverage at npr.org/politics.
I'm Ron Elving.
And I'm Ken Rudin.
Join us again next week for It's All Politics from NPR.
I love to go wandering along mountain track, and as I go I love to sing my knapsack on my back.
Just kissed a girl named Maria, and suddenly I found how wonderful a sound can be. Maria, say it loud, and there's music playing. Say it soft, and it's almost like praying. Maria, I'll never stop saying Maria. Oh,